I have a slide presentation again.
Okay.
I had two items, so that's, yeah, right there. Good afternoon. My name is Steve Schimmick. I am with two organizations, the Otter Project and Monterey Coast Keeper. I'm speaking to you today as Monterey Coast Keeper. You asked me to focus on what is new, and so that's what I'll try and do my very best. We named the proposal the Blue and Green Proposal, so you know, trying to give it that snappy name. Next slide.
Steve, can you hang on just a second?
20 minutes.
All right. So here we go. I'd like to give you, first of all, a very quick kind of tour of our area. I mean, we have ag right up to the very brink of our waterways in the Salinas Valley, and this is part of the problem. Next slide. We also have people that are doing clearing and clearing of the riparian vegetation in our area, and this is clearing all the way down to sand and dirt. This is taken from about, to give you an idea of the scale of this, this is taken from about 2,000 feet. Up, I was flying, so I know how high I was. That's a ranchette down in the lower right-hand corner, or a ranch, and ag buildings and outbuildings. And you can see that's a huge amount of clearing. Next slide. Another slide just showing that we have ag right up to the very brink of the edge of the water. And this just leads to a whole series of problems as far as pesticide applications, nitrate applications, erosion, lack of vegetated buffer, lack of habitat. Next slide. We also have problems in winter. A lot of our fields go fallow, and then when it rains, when we do get big rains, that we have huge runoff. And this can clog waterways. This can also erode. Many of our pesticides adhere to sediment particles. And so when we get erosion like this, it's not just the sediment. It's also the pesticides and those pesticides that are adhered to that fine sediment that end up in our waterways. Next slide. But let's talk about water. You've seen some of these slides. We don't have a problem everywhere. And so when I think when we try and grapple with this problem and we talk about the hot spots, I mean, I think that there's some room to give. I think that there's some room to tier when we talk about what are we going to require various people. The issue that we have, to be very frank, is the fact that the most profitable land is the most impaired land. That's the problem. Next slide. So here's kind of a little closer view of nitrate in the lower Salinas. Now red is over standard. Arrow again is increasing and getting worse, and that's statistically increasing over the past 5 years. Next slide. Here's Santa Maria. So those are those two hot spots, the lower Salinas and lower Santa Maria. Those are areas where we have very significant problems that are getting worse, and these slides are looking at the parameter of nitrate as nitrogen, and this is data from your website. Next slide. Toxicity in sediments and invertebrate survival. So in other words, this is where you dump in some invertebrates, some water fleas, some small crustaceans, and see how many live and how many die. Again, you have the same hot spots. Next slide. Looking again at the lower Salinas, when you look at sediments, there is some speculation that generally you're talking about either legacy pesticides or you're talking about pyrethroids. Pyrethroids tend to adhere to sediment particles. So I heard one statement earlier today that we don't know if it's organophosphate or if it's pyrethroids. I think that if you talk to some people that are wise in this field, above and beyond my wisdom, I think that they will tell you that pyrethroids are displayed kind of as sediment toxicity and organophosphates as water toxicity. Next slide. This is not rocket science. In other words, this is from your own report talking about DPR and talking about the fact that In the lower Salinas River, you have by threefold more application of active ingredients of pyrethroid pesticides. Next slide. Now let's look at the water. So that was the sediment. And again, you have the exact same hot spots. Next slide. So this is invertebrate survival in water now. And again, you see that you have the same hot spot. This is the lower Salinas again, and you see that you have dots increasing, getting worse. Next slide. Again, this is not rocket science. You've seen this slide before, diazinon. This is the amount of diazinon used statewide. If you look at that number for the Salinas Valley, 64,200, and I can't, my eyes are weak, it looks like 257. This is use of pounds of active ingredient. That is 55% of the diazinon used in the entire state of California is used in that little sliver of the lower Salinas Valley. These are not my numbers. These are DPR numbers. Next slide. And then we had the groundwater and nitrate in groundwater. I think Monterey County Water Resources Agency has great data. Unfortunately, all their data is under confidentiality agreement. So when they talked about the fact that they can provide you with reports, I would hope that you could get the raw data and look at it well by well. I'd love to see that information too. But this is public health and USGS, and those are square mile quadrats where they found water above, in these well samples, where they found water above drinking water sample. Everywhere there's red, that's water above the drinking water standard. Next slide. So now I want to talk about the next few slides are going to be very dense. And so I want you to understand the concept here. This is the 2004 the old waiver, the one that you just extended. And you look at, it deals with certain things, and I mean, every slide now will be consistent. It dealt with tailwater contaminants, and it dealt with tailwater toxicity. And the question is was there a set of standards? Was there a timeline? And was there monitoring? Those are three things that are required, as I understand it, and I'm not a lawyer, but those are the things required by the law. You have to have a timeline, you have to have monitoring, and you have to have standards. So now we've got the old waiver. It dealt with tailwater, both toxicity and contaminants. It really didn't talk about groundwater, didn't talk about stormwater, didn't talk about riparian protection. And those are areas that we now know today we have problems with, and I would say that now that we know that we have those problems, I would say that there's an obligation to now deal with those problems. Next slide. So then you look at the staff proposal, and what you see is that the staff proposal now goes across the board, and not in every place, but it has basically standards, it has timelines, and it has monitoring for each one of those parameters. That's the kind of proposal that we're looking for, right? We're looking for a proposal that has, you know, standards that are clear and intelligent. We're looking for timelines, not five-year timelines. Nitrate's going to take 30 to 50 years to deal with, maybe. We acknowledge that, not looking for a five-year timeline, but there has to be an incremental timeline. You have to move in a direction. Next slide. So now you add our proposal to that. And what you see is that we try and fill in a couple of the gaps. Not specifically, but with specific information. But what we wanted was, in red there, is the differences that we have between our proposal and the staff proposal. We want clarification on groundwater contaminant monitoring. There's monitoring when a person applies, but there's no regular monitoring. We want to know what that is, and we want to beef that up. Next slide. Now I took ours off, and you've got the 2004, 2010, and the ag proposal, and the Price Postal Parma proposal, and now I know I am characterizing their proposals. They should speak for themselves. But this is our view, and I'll just say that, our view of their proposals. We feel that their proposals fall short of the 2004 conditional waiver. They don't cover nearly as much. And again, do they have standards? Do they have a timeline? Is there group monitoring? Next slide. So what are the components? I've covered this. Next slide. Now let's look at the proposals. Green is good, red is bad. The staff proposal, you know, you've got standards, timelines, and monitoring, those things that are required by the law in the staff proposal and in the green and blue proposal. I would suggest that you do not find those things in the other proposals. Next slide. I'd like to answer a few questions that came up at the last meeting. Do we really need individual monitoring? Yes, there's hot spots and conditions are getting worse. Both these areas have had group monitoring by Preservation Inc., and we're seeing no improvement. We're seeing no incentive to improvement because there's no individual monitoring. There's no pressure on that person to show their work, and that's important. That is incentive. Next slide. Will confidential, voluntary, on-farm, so lots of caveats there. No, those are quotes. Smart sampling work. Next slide. I'd say no. We've learned more about smart sampling, but at least the way it was initially presented, there was no description of reliability. There was no description of what parameters. There was nothing was being reported, no incentive to improve, and you get what you pay for. No, it just didn't work. And it wasn't monitoring, which is a parameter that's required by the law. Next slide. I don't want to keep slamming. Where can we give? Next slide. Maybe areas with no problems should have lesser monitoring. Maybe only group monitoring in those areas. If there aren't problems and they aren't right next to a 303D list, maybe they don't need to monitor as much. Next slide. Here's a new one for you. Maybe for the first 2 years out of the five-year permit, they don't have to show their work. Maybe they are required to monitor, but they are required to understand their problems, and they know that in year three, they will have to show and report their data. This would be a tremendous incentive to improve. 2 years. Toxicity they can deal with in 2 years. Next slide. Do we really need riparian vegetation and vegetated buffers? Again, my answer is predictable. I know that. I would say yes. These are the conditions that we have right now. I would say that you can't achieve the goals that you want to achieve without riparian and without vegetated buffers. Next slide. In many areas, surface water recharges groundwater. If that nitrate and rich and pesticide rich water reaches the surface water, it's going to end up in the groundwater too. And then there are other beneficial uses above and beyond using that water for ag. This water is supposed to be swimmable, fishable, drinkable. You know, when are we going to have that? When are we going to say that you can use the water, but you have to return it clean? Water is so short in this area that it has to be reused. That's critical. I also take exception with the Ag Commissioner's report. The Ag Commissioner's report, which was said by some board members, were so glad they did an economic analysis. They used 150 feet when not even 100 is required in many areas. They ascribe to their values what they're having to do for food safety, and they tacked that on to your values. Look at their report. And their values do not look at the economic destruction that is going on with all these other things, with urban, what is going on with urban users? What is going to impacts to beneficial use? How about the health benefits impacts of all this? That was a terrible economic analysis, so one-sided and grossly overestimated. Next slide. You've heard some research that some scientists stand up here and say, well, there's research is inconclusive. Well, Four slides, real quick. Here's one, just read the bold stuff. You know, this is a use of constructed wetlands to remove pesticides from agricultural tailwaters. Loads reduced 95% for pyrethroids, 96 to 98% for organic phosphates. Next slide.
That speaker, though, Steve, was referring to nitrate.
We'll get there. Do we really need riparian vegetation and vegetative buffers? Here's another report. You can get rid of with a 20-meter buffer, you can get rid of 88% of the sediment. 20-meter buffer removes about 90% to 97% of nitrate and phosphate from farm runoff. 30-meter buffer removes 93% of pesticides. Next slide. Now people that have looked at varieties of research and done and looked at just a bunch of stuff. Here's a guy that did a review of 140 different sources. It's shown that these things work. They trap sediment and runoff and reduce erosion. There's just all these benefits of having these riparian zones. These are treatment devices. Vegetated buffers and riparian zones are water quality treatment, just like when you talk about stormwater runoff for cities and low impact development. Same concept. Next slide. Here's another guy that looked at 137 sources. And he's saying that temperature control, degradation from direct inputs, pollutant removal capacities, there's all these benefits from buffers. Next slide. I hope you'll look at this slideshow again. Where can we give? Again, where can we give? Maybe the new FDA food safety marketing agreement will require vegetated instead of scorched earth buffers. I think we would all want that. Next slide. Maybe 100 feet could be reduced. What's the scientific literature say? I would say that you're looking at diminishing returns over about 50 feet. I don't think you need 100 feet. Next slide. Concentration versus load has been brought up on several occasions. Well, this water is supposed to be swimmable, fishable, drinkable. What matters to a swimmer? Concentration. What matters to a fish? Concentration. What matters to drinking water? I would say load, because we're talking about the amount of stuff going down into that groundwater, but also concentration if it's a shallow source. Concentration matters a lot. Next slide. I also think that if you look at the past 5 years, there's 2010, you don't have data for that yet, but this is the rainfall. Well, people are saying, wow, you know, we're doing so much better job with our agriculture and using so much less water. There's less water to give, right? This is rainfall over the past 5 years, and I'll bet you this almost mimics some of the load data that they're talking about. Next slide. Should the board require educational credits? That was a hot topic at the last wrap-up. Next slide. Who's going to get educated? The grower? The owner? Is the same grower going to be there, you know, at the end of this permit cycle or the next year? Who are you going to educate? Are you really going to enforce education credits? Are you good at educating people? Or are you a regulatory agency and a regulatory board? We suggest that you are a regulatory board and that you should give the growers clear, concise standards. There are plenty of people out there that will give them advice, both free and for a fee. Tell them the mark that they have to meet, and they will find the help to do it. Next slide. This is what you have. This is what I live with.
Where is that, by the way?
Trembladero Slough, I think. Yeah, right out of Castroville.
September 15th, 2009.
Yep.
What does that flow into?
Moss Landing. just about every bad thing that you could go on with water is right there. Okay. It's a good summary slide. So this is what you have. Next slide. This is what you say where you want to go. This is your vision. You want to have healthy aquatic habitats, proper land management, clean groundwater by 2025. That's what you want. That's your vision. Next slide. What will get you there? That's my question for you, and that's where I'll leave you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your comments. Any questions or comments by the board for Mr. Shimek? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we have like 31 cards, so want to take a break right now?
Yeah.
Okay.
I just want to make sure you didn't overlook the Marine Sanctuary Agricultural Water Quality Partners group that we allotted. Can't remember,
right
15.
Right on the top of this list, but did we allot them any?
Yeah, 15.
We did.
Okay.
That's
thanks.
I wasn't
sure. Sorry.
Okay, so we'll start with you as soon as we come back here in about 10 minutes.